Hello and welcome to another episode of Fourth Estate, your weekly roundup of media and journalism news on 2SER and the Community Radio Network. My name is Isabel Summerson, and joining me in the studio this week are Sarah Lamarquand, columnist for The Daily Telegraph, Marcus Strom, deputy foreign editor of The Age and Sydney Morning Herald, and Anthony Lowenstein, columnist for The Guardian and many things besides. And on the phone we have Monica Attard, contributor to CNN and The Hoopla. Thank you all for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Nice to be here.
Possibly the biggest media story last week was the resignation of Mike Carlton. The Sydney Morning Herald's columnist quit in a fit of pique after he was told that he would be suspended over abusive emails replying to readers of his July 26 column on the Israel-Gaza conflict. Like Carlton, news of the resignation has divided readers and sections of the media. The jubilant reaction at News Limited has been widely noted, as has the regret among his Fairfax colleagues. Monica, I'll put this first question to you. How much precedent is there for journalists or columnists being disciplined over interactions with readers in this way?
I don't know that I can accurately answer that question. However, I think that most media organisations would keep a fairly close watch on what their journalists do publicly online. And certainly the ABC does, and it has a fairly stringent social media policy. And there have been cases where ABC journalists have been told to, you know, pull their socks up and not be quite so rude or outspoken online. And this is, a different case, as there was a little bit of a history behind it, as in that he had been fairly vocal on Twitter for quite some time. And it was complicated, of course, by the subject matter, which was the column. And, you know, it has to be noted, of course, that he was not disciplined because of the content of the column, which was a particularly good one. He was disciplined because of his online behaviour. But look, I think that in answer to your question, there have been cases where journalists have been pulled up on it. But as to accurate numbers, I really couldn't say. I mean, I'm sure Sarah would have a better idea of what happens at News Limited. But certainly, I think at the ABC, there have been a couple of cases. And I'm sure at the Sydney Morning Herald as well.
This is the Catherine Devaney case.
That's right, Catherine Devaney, exactly. Well, she was sacked, wasn't she?
That's right.
Well, these days, most of us in the media are encouraged to respond to our readers and listeners, some of whom may have pretty harsh feedback on what's been said. Surely it must be difficult sometimes not to react in the way that Mike Carlton did. Sarah, you touched on this in the telly last week. What are your thoughts?
Of course, it is difficult. You're only human, and often the readers forget that. Like a lot of other columnists, I've got, as I said in the paper the other day, I've had, you know, correspondents that would leave a Long Bay inmate blushing. I've had to call the police on particularly isolated and regrettable incidents where rape threats have now ridiculously and horrendously become a thing, obviously primarily targeted at female columnists. But aggressive feedback is par for the course, and certainly I'm sure that a lot of what Mike Carlton was on the receiving end was completely unwarranted. But I do maintain that you have to conduct yourself with a degree of civility. And I think everyone in the media has to remember that you are lucky to be given a forum. Someone like me, who's in a position where I have a column, like Mike Carlton, that is something that you can't take for granted. And people that don't have that luxury, which is, let's face it, most of the population, they will come at you aggressively sometimes. And I'm not endorsing that. And I think in my dealings, a little bit of humour goes a long way. I find probably, I don't know what the other panellists think, 8 out of 10 times just the most simple reply can disarm people, because all of a sudden it's like, wow, there actually was a human being on the other end of that column. I thought it was, I don't know what they think, but everyone that works in all aspects of the media, TV, radio, everyone gets very toxic feedback, and just engaging with people in a polite or humourful fashion can really, like I say, disarm them.
Yeah, I think that's right, Sarah. I mean, I've had exactly the same reaction, that when, you know, people come at me with fairly heavy criticism, just a polite response is usually enough to disarm them, usually. I mean, I'm sure that there are cases, and particularly when it concerns stories about the Middle East, when that's not the case. But generally, people will react well to a polite, you know, thank you very much for your comment, and, you know, I've taken note of it, and nice of you to write. Bye-bye. Mm.
I think, though, in some ways, one of the things I think that hasn't been said, this is not really to me an issue about Mike Carlton's behaviour. There's no doubt that I think he was ill-advised to respond sometimes as strongly as he did, both publicly and privately on Twitter and on email, from what we've seen now. But this, to me, is not really a question about Mike Carlton being rude or not rude. This is a wider issue. This is about what he was writing about. The reason, obviously, that Fairfax gave to potentially suspend him, and then he obviously chose to resign, was about his apparent rudeness. But this is really about the way in which people cover this issue and the way news organisations choose, this issue being Israel-Palestine. There's no doubt that any news organization will know that if you are a very strong critic of Islam, of Muslims, of issues around that, you will be attacked by various people. I can't think of one example, I'm happy to be corrected, where a columnist at News Limited or Fairfax or anywhere else for that matter is going to be fired, even censured. I can think of at least five major columnists at Fairfax and News Limited who have spent years demonising Islam. No one's talking about firing them or censoring them. This is about the fact that, yes, Carlton maybe was ill-advised in how he responded, but the reason that Fairfax was so concerned, with obviously some lovely helpful pressure from News Limited, was that they realised that in terms of the power of both business interests, pressure on the Fairfax board, and for that matter, the way in which an Israel lobby had, which has every right to do, organise a campaign against Carlton, because as far as they're concerned, having a very strong critic of Israel is a problem. And in some ways, although the Jewish community, which I'm a Jew myself, but the Jewish community likes to talk about an open and free press, but they feel uncomfortable when there are very strong critics of Israel. So ultimately, this, I think, showed gutlessness on Fairfax's part in the extreme, and reflects, I think, badly to the point where now many in the Muslim community, in my view correctly, are saying that they would potentially boycott Fairfax or encourage the Muslim community not to engage with Fairfax because of their shoddy treatment of one of their former staff, Mike Carlton.
Marcus, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, obviously, I can't speak for Fairfax. I can speak for myself. Look, I think the broader Israel-Palestine dispute and war is the context, but I will remind you, he has not been censured or criticised internally by Fairfax, by his managers, for that column. In fact, his column is seen as an important part of the breadth of Fairfax debate and opinion. I have a lot of sympathies with your column in terms of it being an honour to have such a platform. But I also think there's a degree of the employer has a degree of care, duty of care as well. And in the age of email and the internet, readers have access to columnists in a way that they never did before. And the editor used to act as the gatekeeper and would protect the employee or the contractor. And it's a fairly new terrain that we're in, where you have such direct contact with people who consume your opinions. And I think it's great, but I think how that's managed, there's an onus on the employer to protect the employee as well. That's with my union hat on a little bit, perhaps. Mm. But I hope Mike will come back. As we've seen, he left us before. Well, That wasn't voluntary. We were on strike and he refused to cross our picket line, and he has a lot of support in the newsroom because of that. And he came back, and I hope he'll come back because I think he's an important voice in Fairfax.
I think also one of the things that I, someone who writes about Israel-Palestine a lot, you do get a lot of abuse, both online abuse and often in print. And I think one of the things I've decided over the years is that in the vast majority of cases, you don't respond. And if you get hate mail, which I do, or death threats for that matter, which I have and continue to do, I publish it all on my website with their email address. That's sort of almost a way, almost to give a finger to people to sort of say, you have the right to be abusive, I guess. It's a free country, hopefully. But I also have the right to respond in a way that I think is partly cathartic for me. And also, I think, to show readers and people who are interested in engaging in tough issues, Israel-Palestine's one, terrorism is a one, abortion definitely is a one, issues that are sensitive, that people like to give you shit, frankly, if you stand up on either side, I guess, of the argument. And that, to me, is one way that I've found has been very helpful, to publish with email as a nice little finger to people.
Wow. Sarah, what do you make of this? Would you follow suit?
Well, I mean, this is a really interesting discussion, and I agree with what Marcus is saying, that we're sort of really at the beginning or maybe the early stages of a learning curve, aren't we? Because the increased accessibility to all people in the media, through social media, through published emails, and everyone, I think the fact that I get a lot of emails in the morning from people that are clearly on their way to work. And, you know, I think going back to what Monica and I were talking about earlier about choosing not to engage, you also have to remember for those stubbornly, puerile people that won't treat anyone with respect, you've got to remember they don't have a lot going on in their lives. You know, if someone's writing to you very aggressively, they're probably not a particularly happy person.
Call them Mike Tyson's behind the keyboard.
Exactly.
Or just trolls. Yeah.
So, but as part of this learning curve, of course, on social media, we have seen lots of people who choose to retweet abusive messages, which would be sort of a social media variation on what you're talking about. Anthony, look, again, everyone has to find their own way. For me, I choose to have a slightly less confrontational stance, maybe. A lot of it does come down to personality. And I don't want to overplay the gender card here, but I can't help but think with Mike Carlton, there was part of me that thought I could sort of see that this was a middle-aged man that wasn't that used to being challenged in a way that maybe as a female columnist who works for an organisation that is obviously subjected to lots of criticism and scrutiny and, you know, sort of cheap jibes from people that don't know your work but just make assumptions, that sort of, for me, it's a little bit water off a duck's back. And I think, you know, you do see that from people across all media organisations. Some people just are a little more thin-skinned than others.
Yeah.
I think that's right. And I think this has really given us all pause to think about Twitter and our use of Twitter. I mean, journalists love Twitter, and it's a way we use it to curate, we use it to comment, but it has opened up an ugly face of abuse that is, the words are freely thrown around and comments that are quite controversial and sometimes, you know, wildly inaccurate and not based on fact are thrown around willy-nilly. And I mean, I'm often shocked by what I see some of my fellow journalists saying on Twitter and some of the views that they express. And I'm pretty old school and tend to believe that journalists shouldn't be necessarily expressing, for example, political views publicly if they're to be taken seriously as reporters of fact. But that happens often on Twitter. And, you know, I think what's happened in the Carlton case is something that should give us all, we should all pause for a moment and think about the way we use the medium, because it can be very, very dangerous.
And I was pretty dismayed but not surprised at the jubilation over the road at Holt Street. I mean, I think the day after, for me, it summed up. The Daily Telegraph had a double-page spread on it, which is with the Boston bomber photoshopped, and it had 300 words on the ICAC proceedings from the day before, and we had a double-page spread on ICAC, and we had 300 words on Mike Carlton. And I think the obsession with Fairfax that happens at Holt Street at the moment is just quite bizarre, and I'm happy working in an organisation that's just getting on with delivering news.
Well, there's a common criticism of news media that it is all doom and gloom, and certainly the headlines of late have been filled with trauma, violence and death. We've got the ongoing story about an Australian couple accused of abandoning their disabled child, an Ebola epidemic that has killed over 1,000 people in Western Africa, and violent conflicts in the Middle East, to name just a few. According to some researchers, the cumulative effect on audiences of being constantly exposed to reports on human suffering is what's called compassion fatigue, a sort of emotional burnout and loss of empathy. So we do hear about this from time to time, but what is less frequently discussed is the impact of public empathy on those who cover these stories. So I'll put the question to the panel. How does compassion fatigue in news consumers affect journalists who dedicate their lives to covering traumatic events? Anthony?
I guess it obviously depends what kind of journalist you are, what kind of organisation you work for. I mean, I speak, I guess, as a freelancer, so I write at the moment for The Guardian, but I've also published with other publications and often go to very difficult places, war zones and other emotionally difficult, like issues about, for example, asylum seekers. I think there's no doubt that the way the media reports these issues, and I'm not talking about The Guardian, I'm saying just in general, and of course different outlets report issues in different ways, is often a problem, because I think there is a sense somehow that people as in the audience feel like somehow if they don't have an emotional response, they therefore switch off. And I think the way, for me, in my experience, that people are more likely to have an emotional response, to be engaged, to want to know more about a story, is through personal stories. It's not an obvious thing to say, but it's an important point. If people say, they read in the newspaper, there's been a million people killed in Congo in the last 5 years, you just think, wow, that's a lot of people. Move on. And obviously, Congo actually happens to be the worst genocide since the Second World War, and most people don't know anything about it. I don't claim to be an expert about that myself, but my point is that when you see those figures, it simply sounds massive, and it is. And if I think you choose to report as journalists, as editors, as publications, issues and stories which have people's lives. That's why I think, for example, the current conflict in Gaza has been very effective and very important to show people the reality of what's happening, because very often there's been some great journalists from the mainstream press and also local Palestinians tweeting and Facebooking and blogging in Gaza itself, showing the human cost of that war, what is happening to people's lives, hospitals being bombed, ambulances being attacked, etc. And I think the reason why that has had such a personal effect and so many people around the world have reacted very critically to Israel is for that reason, because people see the personal aspect, how it's affecting average citizens, children, women in the conflict zone. So I think it's important these organisations think about that, and some do a very good job, and some I think are more interested in a kind of a shocking headline and they move on. I think constant interest in an issue is not something news organisations do very well. Ongoing conflict coverage.
Is compassion fatigue an issue that journalists consider when they're going about their work, Marcus?
Yes. I mean, it's something I think about every day on the foreign desk for the Sydney Morning Herald. We have to present stories from across the world online, on our tablet and in print. And we are very aware that we don't want people to turn the page, and we don't want people to move over to the next link. And the question of how to engage people on issues that are very traumatic does occupy my mind every day. And the fatigue actually affects me. And I find, my job, I have to look through a lot of gruesome photos every day. I have actually burst into tears at work because of the horror of the images that I've seen, and that's in the comfort of my own desk. But trying to find a personal way into that humanizes stories and makes them relevant to people's lives is what we try to do on a daily basis. And I think people don't get tired of those stories. I think the way that what's happening in Syria is being dealt with, the front page of The Australian today and page 2 of The Telegraph, is one way of dealing with it that personalises it, but I don't think in a way that makes people engage with the story. It sensationalises it. Yes, this is something horrific that has happened, but it doesn't actually give people an inside to the story of what's happening in Syria or in Iraq. And it is a difficult thing to do, but that's what we try and do every day, and we're very aware of it.
So if people are avoiding watching the news or reading news because of the sort of relentless negativity in headlines, should the media ask itself how much is too much bad news?
I think that question will start to trickle down a little bit because of online journalism. There was a colleague attended a conference in New York recently, which was about mobile devices, and it had people from all across America and lots of, you know, small online startups. And one of them has been extremely successful, getting millions and millions of hits every day, and they simply exist on a mobile, and their edict is only good news. Now, obviously, that is not a model that the entire mainstream media could or should hope to replicate, but there's certainly a lesson.
Is that Upworthy?
It could be, yes.
Which is massive, Upworthy, so yeah, it's
yes.
A very popular
song.
Yeah.
I definitely think that is obviously, feeding into one of the aspects of compassion fatigue. It is a difficult thing, and what this research also showed is when people connect and find empathy for a story it's a pretty inexact science. It's just a moment where they are able to connect with the story beyond a headline, beyond the statistics, beyond the horror of what they're hearing. And as Marcus and Anthony both said, obviously personalising stories is a way of doing that. It can't be done all the time. So I think we all of us sort of worry from time to time, why do some stories get more coverage than other stories? I know recently with MH17 there was a lot of discussion, do we care more that these lives were Australian than from the rest of the world? And these are very important conversations to have, and I don't pretend to have the answers. I do simply think that human beings simply can't connect with everything, and I would like to think that a lot of people that locally did resonate with that story. With Malaysian Airlines, it wasn't necessarily that they value life less in other parts of the world. It's just that for them, they can only connect with so much.
Monica, do you think it's possible for the media to perform its role of keeping people informed and avoid bringing on compassion fatigue?
Look, I think it's a very difficult question, because if media starts to, you know, monitor how much bad news it puts out there, then somebody loses, you know, large numbers of people can lose out. I just don't think it's our job to censor the news in that respect. News is just by definition bad. It's not generally not happy. And I don't know that we should be saying, well, we've had too much Syria today, so let's not talk about Congo, and we've had too much MH17, so let's not talk about some other tragedy in some other part of the world. I mean, I think that news is what it is. It's news, and we have a responsibility to inform our audience of what is occurring in the world and all its ugliness and all its danger and sadness. And yes, we do. You know, I get tired too. I mean, I'm a news junkie, and I'm online most of the day, and sometimes it's overwhelming, and I feel a palpable sense of sadness, and especially in the last few weeks when it's been really, really heavy. But I do think that we have a responsibility to keep people informed of what's going on everywhere. It really saddens me, for example, that, you know, Syria has dropped off the news radar in the way that it has, when it's just so appalling. The loss of life, the displacement of human beings is so extraordinary, but we tend not to talk about it because we think that people can't relate to it. We've had too much of it, you know, ditto Afghanistan. You know, and then you get into a game of weighing up lives against lives. You know, we lose 38 people, and that dominates the news cycle for the period that it has. So, you know, it's a very, very difficult question, but I certainly wouldn't advocate that we begin to censor the news in any way.
We can actually monitor the number of people reading these stories now, of course, online, and we do that regularly. And I'm generally impressed with how people are consuming their news, and obviously the people go after the tittle tattle, but they are coming to the Sydney Morning Herald for serious coverage of big events.
Okay, well, let's move on. And last week, the media and marketing website Mumbrella published a small piece on a typo in the Daily Telegraph, in which the name of entertainment correspondent Jonathan Moran was misspelled as Jonathan Moron.
Poor guy.
Ironically, there was at least one typo in the Mumbrella story on the telly's typo. Mumbrella wasn't the only one uncovering them last week. Media Watch opened with the misspelling of the word mystery in a Channel 10 promo. So it seems that we in the media love a typo, as long as it's not our own. But are they really newsworthy, and do readers and viewers care? Monica, I'll come to you first. When is a typo newsworthy?
Oh, well, when it's the top story on Media Watch, absolutely. You know, I mean, what would Media Watch be without the typos? Look, you know, they're mostly amusing. They can sometimes be a bit offensive, particularly to the person or issue involved. But, you know, they're funny, I suppose, and they're important. I mean, what comes to my mind is when I'm reading a story, whether that's, I have to say, Marcus, generally on the Fairfax media, and, you know, there are glaring typos or misspellings or words repeated. And, you know, you just think, bring back those bloody subs. You know, we need the subs. That's what we need. We need a lot of them, because no journalist can sub their own copy, let's face it.
Why do you think the media takes such glee in reporting others' typos, Sarah?
Oh, because we love other people's mistakes.
Exactly.
Well.
Yeah. That's right. The only thing we love more than other people's misfortune is other people's grammatical mistakes. So, and it, you know, it's probably a little bit of that there, but for the grace of a good eye of an editor, go I. So, look, honestly, As a journalist, it really aggravates me. I hate typos. I hate them in my own products. I hate them in everything else. But I have to admit, I laughed. I laughed at the Jonathan Moran typo. I laughed at mystery. By the way, they constantly misspell my name wrong. It's just that it's not as newsworthy because you can misspell my name with the odd R or H can go missing, but it doesn't become an insult. So I suppose I'm lucky in that way, in that Mumbrella don't pick up on that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm the same. My name is misspelled all the time as well. I don't really get offended by it. But I think yes, it's funny. But yes, it does go to the issue. And a lot of, I think, particularly older readers, in my experience, older being, I don't know, older, those who remember a time where there were maybe less typos, do wonder and worry that there are less people who are checking copy, which is just the nature of the mainstream media having less money or choosing to spend less money on those kind of people. Unfortunately.
I think they're good just when they're funny, but yes, we need the subs.
Indeed.
Yeah.
But there has been a shift in the newsroom. Subs used to be the kings and sometimes queens of the newsroom, but they aren't anymore.
Yeah.
Yes, well, I'm sure we all miss those days. But that's all we have time for on this week's episode of Fourth Estate. Thank you very much to our panel, Anthony Lowenstein, Sarah Lamarquand, Marcus Strom and Monica Attard.
Thanks,
Isabel,
for tuning in. If you'd like to hear this or any other episode again, you can find all our podcasts on the 2SER website. You can also follow us on Twitter and on Facebook. We'll be back again at the same time next week. Until then, goodbye. Thank you.